Well, the same thing happened like twice in a row. And when that happens, it kind of like tells you maybe you should pay attention. First time, I was in Seattle. I was at a church up there. We were standing and singing an 11 o'clock style praise song called Yes, I Will. And the lyrics went in part like this. I count on one thing, the same God who never fails, will not fail me now. You won't fail me now. Yes, I will. Lift you high in the lowest valley. Yes, I will. Bless your name. Oh, yes, I will. Sing for joy when my heart is heavy all my days. Oh, yes, I will. And at the moment, I was standing next to someone for whom those lyrics were just not ringing true. For whom all the evidence suggested that God was indeed failing her, had been failing her for quite some time, that at the very best, God wasn't doing anything at all, and at worst, simply had it out for her. And I wondered, how do you sing that song when your heart is breaking and your world is collapsing? Feels like God is holding out on you, if he even cares at all? How much does it hurt to sing that song then? And I was thinking, really? Really, is that the way it works? Is it that simple? Just sing, yes, I will, and everything's all good? The very next time was the very next time that I was in worship. And it was right here a couple of weeks ago. I was standing right there where I'm standing now this morning, and we were singing a very similar song at our 11 o'clock service. It's called Do It Again, and its lyrics, in part, go like this. Walking around these walls, I thought by now they'd fall, but you have never failed me yet. This is my confidence. You've never failed me yet. And again, I couldn't help thinking of all the people I know in this congregation who invited me into their stories, people whose lives have been torn apart by any manner of tragedy, who feel totally broken, whose pains and sadness wrap themselves like a blanket around their soul. And I had to stop singing because the sorrow was constricting my throat and stinging my eyes. Now, I don't want to get you all depressed. It might be too late. Might have already done it. So I thought maybe I'd tell you about the time that I talked Barbie into riding with me on Space Mountain. Okay. 'Cause that moment is permanently seared into my psyche. I mean, you know the ride, right? The roller coaster in the dark. Well, Barbie doesn't like roller coasters. I love them. And we were pretty recently married. We weren't married long enough yet for Barbie to say, "What's the matter with you? I'm not getting on that thing." Okay? And we weren't married long enough for me to realize that there were some things she wasn't going to suddenly just like because I talked her into it. And so we got on, and away we went. And by the first free fall, she was crying. Jarring turn after sudden drop, and now she's shaking, and tears are coming down her cheeks, and she's starting to whimper, and she's becoming more and more terrified of the ride that she's on, and I'm becoming more and more terrified of the consequences that await me when we get off the ride. And I'm thinking maybe sometimes you find yourself on a ride that you didn't expect, and I'm not talking about Space Mountain. I'm talking about life. And you feel like you're white-knuckled holding on, like it's all going to come flying off the tracks any second, like you're going to lose your grip and get thrown from the car, and you just cannot take one more drop. And then the next drop comes, and another one after that, and then a jolting twist. Here's the truth, and we all know it. If we live, we will suffer. We'll hurt. It's inevitable. I mean, I don't have to give you a laundry list of examples or describe it to you because you know it very well for yourselves, don't you? Now, maybe, just maybe, you're one of the lucky few for whom life is just one endless trip to Disneyland where there aren't even any lines and no waiting, and if so, you know what, good for you. Good for you. But I'll bet most of us here have spent time in that other place where discouragement or disappointment or setbacks pile up one after another, building until they hammer your heart, huh? Or where an unexpected, traumatic, life-shattering moment comes from out of nowhere and just knocks you off your feet. And let's just be honest with each other. Can we just be honest? Holding on to faith when life gets bumpy and frightening and dark and it hurts and it's full of sudden drops and wrenching turns, well, that is tough. That's tough. And what can happen is that the suffering hurting you becomes the questioning you, becomes the doubting you, and that final you can find yourself teetering on the brink of despair. What you thought you knew about God all this time doesn't seem to work anymore. And what adds to the hurt is when you come to church and it feels like you're supposed to already have your act all together like everybody else obviously does. And it's embarrassing to admit when you're standing next to someone who's singing full-throated about their confidence in God, how God has never failed them yet, that you don't feel that way at all. At all. So the next few weeks, we're going to be talking honestly as we can about this kind of stuff, about why God isn't fair, and how to make it through, and what to do when your faith is fragile. Because even though I've been there, and to tell you the truth, there are times right now when I find myself feeling stuck on a ride I don't want to be on. I believe, and let me just say this, it's by the power of the Holy Spirit alone, because I sure don't have that strength in me. I believe that despite the evidence or the lack of it, God gives us ways to survive such times. And not only survive them, but to nurture a faith that can withstand and even flourish amid the inevitable twists and turns of life. So today, I want to take a short look at Joseph's story from the book of Genesis. Now, it's a long one. It's too long to take a deep dive into here this morning. But if you want to read it for yourself, it begins in chapter 37 of Genesis, and it runs all the way to the end of the book. And the passage we just read today comes from the end of that story. Okay, but just in case you're not all that familiar with Joseph, let's kind of review it for a minute. Let's take a quick bird's eye view of that story. And it begins with 17-year-old Joseph having a dream that seems to suggest that someday his older brothers are all going to bow down to him. Now, it's one thing to have that dream. It's another thing entirely to tell your brothers about it, especially when they already hate you because you're the youngest. And Dad doesn't waste any opportunity to remind everyone that he loves Joseph the most, including giving him and only him a very special coat. But Joseph is your typical youngest child. You've got any youngest child here? Raise your hand if you're a youngest child. Yeah, see, we know, don't we? Okay? Youngest children all think that the world revolves around them. Okay? And so youngest child Joseph goes to his brothers a second time and he says, "Hey guys, guess what? I had another dream. And in it, you're all bowing down to me again. Isn't that awesome?" And his brothers look at each other and they say, "That's awesome. Let's kill him." Now, the thing with these dreams is that God is letting Joseph in on his plan. God's got a purpose. And it's going to involve Joseph, but sometimes God's plan is not a straight line. And sometimes God's plan has drop-offs and twists and turns, and it starts to seem like if there is any plan at all here, all it has to offer is disappointment and trouble and a God who's not really doing anything about it. We tend to be okay with God's plan, as long as looks the way we want it to. But the way it's going to look in Joseph's life, not so much. One day, Dad sends Joseph to check up on his brothers out where they're grazing the sheep. And they see him coming and they think, wow, this is it. This is our chance to get rid of that little pain in the neck. Yeah. But one of the brothers talks him into throwing him into a hole instead. And then when a caravan of traders comes along, they decide to make a little bank off their little brother, and they haul him up and they sell him into slavery while they go home with his coat dipped in blood, crying big old fake tears to convince Dad that Joseph is dead.
Oh, Dad, we couldn't help it. We tried so hard. We're as sad as you are.
But Joseph's not dead. He's a slave in Egypt, and his owner is a guy by the name of Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials. And Potiphar's wife takes an unhealthy interest in Joseph because the Bible says he was well-built and handsome. All right? And I'm just going to let you paint that picture for yourself in your own brain, okay? Okay. And she wants him to go to bed with her. But Joseph refuses, so she claims he's the one who's been making the advances, and Potiphar throws him in jail. But here's what Genesis says about that. It said, while Joseph was there in prison, the Lord was with him. While he was in prison, the Lord was with him. God had not abandoned him, though all the evidence suggested that he had. Well, it happens that two of Pharaoh's officials, a cupbearer and a baker, are also in prison at that time, and they have dreams, and Joseph interprets those dreams. And their dreams say that one of them is going to be executed, and the other is going to be restored to Pharaoh's service. And sure enough, that's what happens. But when the cupbearer gets out, he promptly forgets Joseph, and Joseph spends another 2 years in prison. And then Pharaoh had dreams. And that's when the cupbearer remembers Joseph and suggests, you know, Pharaoh, there's this guy. What was his name? Joseph. I think it was Joseph. And he was pretty good at figuring out dreams. And so Pharaoh brings Joseph in, tells him his dreams, and Joseph explains that there are going to be 7 years of great crops followed by 7 years of famine. So maybe Pharaoh might want to set aside some food during the good years to get them through the bad ones. And Pharaoh thinks, whoa, that's a pretty good idea. And so he puts Joseph in charge of that. And sure enough, when the famine strikes, Egypt has plenty of food to get them through. But guess who gets hungry? Joseph's brothers. So Dad sends them to Egypt to try and get food, and one thing leads to another, and they end up in front of Joseph, who's now the second most powerful person in the country. And they don't know it's him at first, but when they find out, they're terrified because they're absolutely sure that Joseph is going to get his revenge. And they had good reason to be worried about that, didn't they? Because who among us would not, after having been sold into slavery by your own brothers, want to exact a little bit of revenge, even if you were a snot back when you were young? But that's not what happened. And that's the part of the story that we read this morning. Joseph assures them, don't be afraid. You intended to harm me. But God, he intended it for good. You were going to hurt me. Part of God's plan. 13 years. Let me say that again. 13 years. That's how long it was from when Joseph's brothers first put him on eBay until he entered Pharaoh's service. 13 years. And along the way, things just kept going from bad to worse to worse to worse. 13 unrelentingly bad years. Now, that's plenty of time for Joseph to lose faith and give up hope and give up on God, because it had to have felt at some point in those 13 years like God had totally given up on him, right? If anyone ever had a reason to feel abandoned by God and left to fend for themselves, it was Joseph, huh? If anyone ever had cause to shake a clenched fist at a silent sky and shout, God, where have you gone? God, why, when I've so needed your help, has nothing happened, nothing changed, nothing improved? What do you mean you've never failed me? You haven't done anything but fail me. That person would be Joseph. And that makes what Joseph says about all of this stuff so much more astonishing. In chapter 45, verse 5, Joseph tells his brother, "Don't be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. So then it was not you who sent me here, but God." Did you get that? It was not you who sent me here. It was God all along. Okay. And in case they didn't get the point, he repeats that in today's reading that we just heard. "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." So Joseph's gone through all these 13 years of awful stuff, and what good did God bring about from all this tragedy that Joseph endured? Well, Joseph says it, the saving of many lives. But don't miss the point here. Okay? It's not just the saving of a lot of random lives. It's the saving also of a particular family, their family, from whom eventually would be born an infant in a manger who would grow up to become a savior on a cross. Joseph chose to trust that God had been at work in this all along, that something good was going on when everything bad was the only thing that seemed to be going on. Now, how does that work? I think it's about perspective, for one thing. You know, we tend to focus on the hurt, don't we? We tend to focus on the feelings of devastation and neglect. We tend to fixate on how this was not the way life was supposed to be, and it has to be somebody's fault, and ultimately the responsibility is God. But Joseph chooses something different in the exact same set of circumstances. That beyond his immediate situation, God is up to something he can't see yet. That God is at work when he doesn't appear to be. That God knows what he's doing, even if it takes 13 years. Now, you all know that I love road trips, right? I know you know that by now. And one of my favorites is from San Luis Obispo up the Central Coast, you know, up to Carmel through Big Sur. But a lot of times, that route is socked in with fog. Okay? And driving through the fog gives you this sense that there is something grand about this place, but it lies just beyond your ability to see it. The road, like an over-permed strand of hair, twists its way into the murky distance. For a fraction of a moment, you think you might be able to make out the breathtaking headlands. You can almost get a glimpse of the craggy coast, but no, not really, because it's covered by the fog. Now, the heart and soul and majesty and beauty of that place is there, but by appearance, it's shrouded in gray. But then, almost without warning, and if only for the briefest of moments, the clouds pull back and it reveals itself. And then you know, this place is majestic. This place is magical. This place is beautiful beyond words. It always was. You just couldn't see it. You and I, we grope through life wondering why this pain has come to us, wondering if we can endure, jostled about like we're on a roller coaster in the dark against our will. But in Joseph's story, we discover that even in those moments when life's murkiest clouds swirl around us, making it difficult to see what all of this is all about, still, we remain in the presence of majesty. We always have been. The Lord was with him in prison, we're reminded. And what Joseph shows us is that there's always something going on when nothing seems to be. Always someone present when we feel most alone, and that God is always working, especially when things seem the worst, and we can hold on to him. We need to hold on to him. We don't always need to see his plan. We just need him. We just need to trust that he has one, that he can see what we can't, and it helps. No, more than that, more than helps. It's everything. It's literally everything. About 30 yards from the end of our ride on Space Mountain, the ride broke down. We sat there for a while in the dark, not moving, not saying much, wondering what's going to happen next. Finally, the lights came on, and they told us we had to get out of the car and walk to the exit. So we did. And when I looked around, I got a different perspective. See, I realized it was in reality just this kind of medium, small roller coaster in a warehouse. That's what it was. It's all it was. Okay? Just a bunch of tubes, nothing really very exciting at all. A much smaller deal than it was in the dark. It really wasn't that scary at all. It just seemed that way until the lights came on and I saw the reality. While Barbie has never, ever gotten on any roller coaster ever again, and I have never, ever tried to talk her onto one ever again, that day, we walked hand in hand toward the door because her hand in mine and ours in God's is stronger and truer than the drops and the twists and the turns. That's a reality. The reality of a God who never fails, even when it takes 13 years.